Now, here is an exclusive interview conducted by Michael Toms with Ram Dass.
Ram Dass, it's good to be with you again.
Thank you, Michael.
There's a lot happening in the world today. One of the things I notice is that there are a lot of books coming out that deal with spirituality, spiritual things, not the least of which is this Conversations with God, but books like The Celestine Prophecy, Mutant Message, Care of the Soul. It seems like the New York Times bestseller list has four or five books that deal with spirituality on it every time I look at it. What about that phenomenon? What do you think's happening today?
Well, I'm delighted the phenomenon's happening because the implication of it is that people are more accepting of the fact that there are non-ordinary states of consciousness and that there are other planes of reality. And I live in that world in which all of that is true. And none of the fact that these things are happening surprises me. Now, you could ask the question of why are beings from other planes bothering with us now? Or the other one is, how are we happening to pick up the stuff now? I mean, let's say it's always being sent, but we just tune in now because of a certain cultural readiness or some critical moment or who knows what it is, you know. As a spiritual practice, a dialogue with an inner being or a higher being or a guru are all incredibly useful to keep straightening your game out, to keep helping you get integrity with your being. And so in that sense, I mean, this is all fine to me. I mean, a lot of the books have in it a lot of melodrama. And I hope mostly honesty, as well as people can be, but I'm sure there are selective distortions in the way this material is reported or the way it's experienced or the way it happens. And the predicament is, as it becomes more acceptable in the society, it gains more power as an economic force, and then a lot of people move in on it in a way that aren't directly having this experience but are really good at imagining themselves having these experiences, which is a different level of the game.
In Conversations with God, the dialogue actually is a dialogue between God and the author, Neil Donald Walsh.
Yeah.
Does God talk to all of us?
Well, I think I'd want to deal with the word talk to and make sure we understand that talk to can be silence, talk to can be the wind, talk to, then I'd say yes. If you're talking about blah, 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 I would say I don't know that most of us need that.
Maybe not all of us will have the experience of writing a book in a conversation with
will
God.
Will all of us have that inner experience of a relationship, a relational thing? No, I don't think so. I don't think it is appropriate for everybody to have it. I think what I see is different strokes for different folks. I mean, there are some people for whom singing to God is their way. For some people, meditating is their way. For others, a dialogue, which is a contemplative kind of visualization form or a form of meeting beings, that's their way. Like Ramana Maharshi said, God, Guru, and Self are one. So you can come at it from any one of those angles. Your root may be with a relationship with God or with Guru or with Self.
I think in the book, Conversation with God, God says that he uses many ways, all ways, to communicate with humans.
Sure.
What I'm wondering is if one gets in touch with one's inner voice, how do you know it's God's voice versus your own intellectual voice or feeling voice or whatever? How do you tell the difference?
You don't know. You don't know. You have to intuitively keep testing and being totally open to disconfirmation all the time. And you've got to stay totally with what your intuitive sense is, that this is what's coming through is useful and harmonious with what you understand the universe to be. And if it isn't, you should, take reflection about that. I don't say you should reject or anything, but you should take reflection about it. I've learned to trust that, and I often, people say, well, why do you feel that way about that? And I say, I don't know, but I trust what I feel, which I never used to do. I used to have to always justify what I felt, and say, well, it's because of, like, you're writing a critique.
In the book, it refers to feelings, too, being a channel for truth or a channel for the soul. And I think about feelings of anger, of great emotion, of upset. I mean, there have been wars fought. There are wars being fought today because people over feelings. One person has one feeling and somebody else has another.
Yeah.
What? Why would feelings be the place? I mean, and are we talking about levels of feelings?
Well, I think that when we're talking about words and thoughts and concepts, we're talking about a plane of reality. You stay on a certain way in which your mind projections define reality very, very, very formally, if you will. Feelings are another form of communication with the universe around you. And every time you try to put them into words, I mean, a poet can play at the edge. But everybody feels the absurdity of speaking about the unspeakable. And in a way, feelings are that dimension which tunes you to a different level of spiritual that starts to move you into another plane of consciousness. It's a doorway. I think feelings are a doorway. Like in devotional yoga, you start out with emotional, relational feeling of I love Jesus or I love Mary or I love Krishna. And, you know, it's just this relational, and you imagine Krishna as the boy playing the flute and all that. And then over time, the whole devotional quality moves into like the whisper, are you there? I'm here. Wow. And just the delicious quality of the sharing of being. And then there's another stage where the dualism starts to, the boundaries start to fall apart. And it's like you're coming to orgasm or something. You're coming into a place of just presence. It's just such thick presence. It's like you're in the presence of God, or you're in presence. That's the way I'd say it. Yeah.
Reminds me of a story from my own life in 1968. In fact, it was when you first came back from India and you appeared in Berkeley. I was living in the Marina District of San Francisco, and I lived in a high rise, a flat, and I looked out over the bay, and I saw that searchlight at the tower at Alcatraz, the lighthouse, which doesn't operate anymore. Doesn't have that, you know, foghorns. Anyway, that light would come around, like it would circle around. And that light became my voice, that inner voice, that was the answer, that God was present.
I've just finished this book on called Aging Lightly. And in it, I talked for the first time about Guru Kripa, which is, it's a path, which is the path of grace of the Guru. When I met my guru in 1967, and then I was with him in 70 to 72, and then he died in 73. And he's continued to be the most active living presence in my life. Now, that's the same. We're talking about exactly the same thing, you know. And what I said was that I had been reticent to talk about it because I didn't want to make people jealous, because I didn't know who to send anybody to that I really felt good about, that good about, you know. And so I always kind of covered it over because I didn't, you know, and it also gurus are misunderstood in the West and all that. But then an interesting thing happened. I did this book, Miracle of Love, in 78, and I got hundreds of letters from people saying, who is this guy? He's in my head, or he's in my heart, or he's coming to me, or he's around all the time. And I began to see the way they were talking about him. They had him the same way I had him. There was the same quality of connectedness, you know. He was their guru now, too. They could have, you know, they had him, too. And I saw, and all the people who had been with Maharaji were all busy. We've been with him, and you haven't. And I saw through that whole thing. It had nothing to do with that. I mean, you know, a lot of the people that were with him didn't get, you know, couldn't get much. So then I started to create a game, and it was called Have Your Own Imaginary Playmate, which was you're going to create an imaginary playmate, and you're going to imbue it with all the qualities of somebody you'd like to hang out with, somebody that's wise, that's humorous, that's kind of a rascal, that is quite empty, that is compassionate, that has incredible love, that's fun. You know, I mean, whatever qualities you want to imbue it. And you can have a body or not have a body, whatever you want, and then just hang out with it. Just bring it along to all social gatherings and just carry on. It's like a silent playmate. And I realized that everybody could have that same game. So that's really dealing with the same issue, it seems to me, as to which form you project that dialogue to be, or you meet, what form you meet. But to say, well, I've met God, so that is more than if you've met, you know, I don't, that to me is a conceptual issue, not, you know.
In conversations with God, there, it seems to be mostly a Christian orientation, although that's debatable. But, I mean, the Father, Son, Holy Ghost kind of ideas there. Do you think God cuts across all the traditions? I mean, we're talking about Krishna, we're talking about God in the Christian tradition, we're talking about Buddha, we're talking about, what do you see?
Well, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says at one point, from time to time, I take form in order to relieve the suffering of my devotees. I sort of see that there is a wisdom that is greater than the wisdom that we know. There is a meta system. There's a larger context in which we exist. And when you're, how that context comes from its non-conceptual nature into our minds, it seems to me is very much a function of the nature of the programming of the receiver. So that a Tibetan Lama meets the fearful deities and the great deities and Tara and all, and a Christian meets the Christian saints, and an American Indian, Native American, meets Native American elders.
So this is not only true in life, but may also be true in death, that we meet on the other side who we've identified with on this side.
I would say that at the stage where we're going through a transformation right after death, where the mind is going through transformation, I would say that you would meet all the projective forms. You would meet all the ways, all the beings in the mind's way you knew them or you conceived of them prior to that. There's a great line in Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi, in which Yogananda's guru said, when I go to be with a devotee, I pick the form that would be most comfortable for that being. And you got a sense of a long closet, you know, with clothing like, today I am Satan, today I am the Lord.
Right, yeah. That's interesting you mentioned Satan, because in the book Conversations with God, God says that we create the devil, essentially, that we create evil. What do you think?
Well, I mean, we create God, too, in that sense of a concept. God, we don't, I mean, this is tricky business, but
yes,
God better watch what God's saying, because everything goes in the sale, you know?
Right,
and it is true. I mean, I think that all concept, everything that you conceive of is a concept that you have imposed through your mind. So, sure. But the question is, how do you formulate or characterize the nature of dualism in a way that doesn't trap you in dualism? You know, I mean, like the line from Manly P. Hall, mm-hmm. One who knows not that the prince of darkness is but the other face of the king of light knows not me. See, yeah. That's the one with the one.
So it's the both and.
It's the both and, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, in the conversation with God, God says that he loves both good and evil.
Sure.
And he says something like, Hitler is in heaven, and until you know this, you won't know me.
That reminds me of Emmanuel's statement. Emmanuel is a being that Pat Rodegast knows and
writes about
and speaks with. Emmanuel described the Holocaust as so many beings getting together and agreeing to take birth for that experience as part of a statement as a compassionate act. And as a way that was also, I'm sure, working out their karma, but it was a compassionate act. It was a collective compassionate act, the far out one. I mean, for the sense of generations of history.
In Conversations with God, Ram Dass, there's a lot of bad prayer. And one of the quotes I'd like to pull from the book is this. The correct prayer is therefore never a prayer of supplication, but a prayer of gratitude. Thankfulness is thus the most powerful statement to God, an affirmation that even before you ask, I have answered. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I would agree with a part of it. I would agree that supplication is off the wall, because when you're asking for something, who are you asking? You're assuming they don't know. And if they know, why would you ask? They'll do what they do out of their infinite wisdom. So what business is it of yours whether they do it?
One of the points made in the book is that the idea of supplication, like, I want this, basically gives you the I want.
Mm-hmm.
You're just an I want. And you're never going to get what you want because you're saying, I want it, and not taking this assumption that God already knows what you want and it's already there for you. You just have to grab it.
I think that that it reinforces desire systems and identification with desire, which is what you're saying. The part of that statement that I would is the kind of directive that what you are to experience is gratitude. I think that's too righteous. It's too trippy. It's a little moralistic, and because what that does is he'll keep you in dualism. You see, forgiveness, gratitude, all of those things keep you. They're wonderful feelings to have, but to say you must have those is cutting off the way in which you and God are one. And if you were God at one, if I pull a splinter out of one finger with the other hand doesn't have to say to the other hand, hey, thanks, because they're both part of the same body. And it's the same thing. Who are you saying gratitude to? You know, don't push me away that far that you can be that you can express that to me. Why keep me in a relationship?
One of the aspects that permeates conversations with God is the idea that we create our own reality. Now, we create our own reality in the midst of many other realities, but how do you see that? Do we actually create our own reality?
I think that let's say the ego, he's talking to the ego. He's talking to an ego that sees things. If he were talking to your soul, he'd be talking differently, I think. Because the soul's perception is probably not distorted by identification with desire.
Here's another aspect which I think you might resonate with and certainly will have something to say, because it seems to cross philosophical lines. This is a direct quote. To live your life without expectations, without the need for specific results, that is freedom. That is godliness. That is how I live.
Delicious. Absolutely delicious. Lovely, lovely statement. Sure. I think that when you live fully in the moment embraces future and past into itself. You are not living with expectations about the future. You're not, you're in no way dependent on the phenomena. You're just delighting in the play without the need for specific results. Well, yeah. See, like in the Gita, Krishna says, be not identified with being the actor and be not attached to the fruits of the action. This is the fruits of the action. There's another one of being identified with the actor. I mean, you say to God, thank you for doing that. God didn't do it. God is it.
Well, isn't this the heart of karma yoga, of service, of the service for the sake of the service, not for the results of the service?
Yeah. Yeah.
Action for the sake of action.
Well, that's doing your dharma. You do what is appropriate to do. What happens is what happens. In God's hands, it's not in your hands. That's one of the secrets for burned-out activists, is to learn that, of how to do something as impeccably as you can without attachment to how it comes out.
Well, this is, I think, burnout is a result of activism without spirit.
Without spirit.
Activism
exactly.
Without soul.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like bearings without grease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you look at some of the people who've come through activism as a path, I mean, I think of people like Maya Angelou and Alice Walker, who were firebrands in their early years and are still firebrands in a sense, but they have a rootedness in their own souls that comes through their activism.
Yeah, exactly.
This idea of living in the moment without thought, without expectations or thoughts of what's going to happen next, and just putting your passion into your act, that's what's important.
Well, you're not completely oblivious of what might happen next. I mean, that all goes into the calculations or into the gestalt out of which comes the action.
Yes.
but you're not, a part of your mind isn't constantly assessing where this is in relation to where it's going, unless that's a functional strategy for getting feedback loops. But but in terms of judging yourself or judging how you do it by the effect, you don't do that. You wouldn't do that. Because there are too many factors involved in every event. I can say I'm going to go to the store, and halfway to the store, Christ appears and says, follow me. I'll probably never get to the store.
How would you define truth?
I would say that truth is not definable, and that all definitions are relative truth. And that's, I mean, that's why I love the way Gandhi saw his life and wrote his autobiography titled Experiments in Truth. Truth. I mean, he was approaching, and he had that great line when he led the march and then stopped it, and the people said, you can't stop this march. And he said, God is absolute truth. I am a human. I only know relative truth, and my understanding of truth changes from day to day, and my commitment must be to truth, not to consistency. It's a great, great teaching. Great teaching, because you're moving constantly towards a deeper truth. You don't ever arrive until you give up moving towards it, but you can be truth. You can't know truth.
We might say that there could be an intellectual truth and a soul truth. There could be a feeling truth.
Well, I don't know what that intellectual truth is.
It's truth that comes out of the mind.
Truth that comes out of the mind. Yeah, I think you're
right.
It's
the kind of truth that comes out of this is the way it is.
Yeah, it's dealing with the paradox, the seeming paradox. It's not really a paradox, but a seeming paradox, that what is true on one plane isn't necessarily true on another. And having to deal with that tension or that disparity or whatever. It's like saying it's all perfect and saying it all stinks. I mean, they're both true, but they're both true in different planes of discourse, you know.
I remember hearing a Jesuit teacher say when I was in high school about how there may be nobody in hell because one of the requirements to commit a mortal sin requires full knowledge of the gravity of the offense against God. How can natural beings have any idea of the
That's
offense
great.
Against a supernatural being?
That's good.
As again, it's that
like
relative
it. That's
absolute.
Lovely. Yeah. It's a good story. Yeah, absolutely. Because you'd be a fool once you understand. You'd be like sticking your fingers in your own eyes or something like that. It would be absurd. Sure.
Are you hopeful, optimistic about the future, Ram Dass?
I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I don't find that an interesting place to hang out. I mean, I optimize what I do for all possibilities. What happens is what happens. See, that's, again, the expectations or attachments. If I had an attachment, there'd be fear. And there's just no attachment. Not that there isn't fear in my life, but that one particular one isn't one of them.
It's interesting you mentioned fear, because fear comes out a lot in the conversations with God as being really almost the synonymous with evil and the opposite of love.
Yeah. Emmanuel says the same thing about fear and love. The two dimensions of fear and love. And I mean, in Buddhism, when you say, what is the root ignorance? The root ignorance is separateness, and separateness is the one that identification with your separateness awakens fear. Fear isn't the same quality as love. It's not the same depth. Love is like presence. Love is a total permeating thing. Fear comes out of division. Fear is in dualism. Love is non-dual.
Love crosses lines in many ways.
Yeah, it has no boundaries. It's boundaryless.
Yeah.
Fear has boundaries. Fear of. Yeah.
It's better to be in love.
It's better to be love.
Be love.
Be loved. Beloved. Beloved. Yeah.
Thanks, Ram Dass.
Thank you, Michael.